Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Miss Navajo Nation talks about her time in the role as her successor is set to be named, and jazz saxophonist Joshua Redman on how he thinks about playing music. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
On day one, we're going to make groceries and housing more affordable. On day one, Kamala Harris says this, we're going to tackle the American southern border. Kamala, day one was 3.5 years ago. What the hell have you been doing the whole time?
Now, nothing's going to happen until after the election, after there's a new Senate in place. And so I just want to reiterate, this agreement is with the current leadership of the Senate.
I kept waiting for my own party's leadership to step up and say, you know what? This needs to be looked into. Not run and bury your head in the sand like it's not even happening.
People get ballots in the mail and they don't submit them. My vote doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We need to have a citizen force in the month of October, all of us, to go chase every single ballot in the month of October.
It would affect burnout because wouldn't you be burned out if you had to teach a class where the kids were acting up and the administrators wouldn't do anything about it? I wouldn't last a year.
Parents and children have the right to feel safe in a school.
Yeah.
Kids shouldn't have to worry about sending their kids off and somebody showing up with a gun.
And with me to talk about some new polls on the initiatives that'll be on the November ballot, J.D. Vance campaigning in the Valley and more, our Marcus Dellartino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Gael Esposito of Creaso Partners. Gael, good morning to you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here to both of you. So, Marcus, let's start with the Republicans' vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, had a couple of events in the Valley this week. And it seems as though the Republican ticket is spending more time in the state than the Democrats. We haven't really seen Vice President Kamala Harris or Governor Tim Walz in the state much. What does it tell you that that Vance is spending as much time here as he is?
Well, it tells me let's reflect back a little bit. When Biden was the nominee, I think effectively a Southwest strategy was off the table for the Biden campaign, meaning he was not performing in Nevada and Arizona. Then we have a switch of candidates. We go to VP Harris. That angle, that line now opens up, that Southwest strategy, I'd call it, because Nevada and Arizona are super tight right now for both candidates. So what we're seeing now is, you know, I think that VP Harris and Walz have spent a lot of time in the Northeast, but I expect them to pivot here shortly. And it will be a ping pong match in between the two campaigns, bouncing in and out of Arizona, Nevada, and into, you know, Pennsylvania mostly, and Michigan, and some of the northeastern states. So yeah. Don't, you know, because you haven't seen them lately doesn't mean they're coming. I expect to see a lot of them in the next month.
Yeah. Gael, what are you seeing in terms of, Marcus mentioned how, you know, Arizona, Nevada, pretty tight. And the conventional wisdom has been that this is going to be as tight, if not maybe tighter than what we saw 4 years ago when President Biden won by, what, like 10,000 votes or something like that. Is that kind of what you're seeing as well?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, Arizona is at the forefront of this political season once again. And I think they're sending J.D. Vance out here to get earned media like this, because right now the Harris campaign is outspending them, outworking them in every other metric. And so I think Marcus is right. You're going to see the vice president and Governor Walz out here shortly. But I think right now this is all about the Trump campaign trying to find ways to get some coverage to make up for that gap.
Do those kinds of events work? Like, do they get people fired up? Do they get the kind of earned media that I was talking about? Do they make an appreciable difference in a campaign?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely fire up your base. There's no doubt about it. And that's sort of the new goal. I would say, you know, 10 years ago, your goal was to move those independent voters into your camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the strategy has changed dramatically on both sides, by the way. And that is just to turn out your base. That those folks that are still question marks aren't going to come to reach a decision and probably won't pull a ballot, or are insignificant enough numbers that you can make it up with turning out your base. And so that's what those events are meant to do, is sort of, yes, get an earned media pop, which, you know, they did. But two is to excite your base and get them excited about chasing ballots.
And, Gail, I would imagine that in a race that is expected to be as close as Arizona, like, winning at the margins means you have to get sort of those marginal voters to figure out who they want to vote for, hopefully you, and then get them to actually vote.
Yeah, and I don't know if J.D. Vance is the right messenger for that. And this was definitely a base event, right? This was put on by Turning Point. These are, you know, people who on MLK Day attacked the civil rights leader and started a campaign to overturn the 1964 Civil Rights Act. There, they have people on staff who were charged with assaulting a queer professor at ASU. These are extreme voices that held this event with J.D. Vance. And I think, you know, his polling numbers are the worst of any vice presidential candidate in a long time. I think they're worse than Sarah Palin's even were. And that's really saying something. He is not the messenger for those marginal voters.
Marcus, I want to ask you about something else in presidential politics this week. We saw the youngest son of the late Senator John McCain, Jimmy McCain, come out and endorse Vice President Kamala Harris. And I believe he actually said that he is maybe becoming a Democrat also, which is perhaps surprising for, you know, the son of such a Republican stalwart in Arizona. And to him, he spoke on CNN and said the incident at Arlington National Cemetery was really a turning point for him. I know you were close to Senator McCain. You worked for Senator McCain. What do you make of the fact that his son is now really coming out in support of a Democratic presidential candidate?
I'm just shocked I would get this question.
Didn't see this one coming.
You know, I was more shocked at the attention that this got in the media. I mean, this wasn't an Arizona story. This was a national story. It was on the Today Show, for God's sakes. And I think to give everybody some perspective, Jimmy just returned from overseas, serving his country. And so I'm not shocked that he would look at a controversial moment, shall we describe it, at Arlington. I'm not too sure anybody knows actually what happened, but certainly it was described as not a sort of peaceful event. And I certainly wasn't shocked that Jimmy would look at switching parties and supporting a different candidate. And, you know, he has that right to do it. But now we've sort of covered, I think, every McCain humanly possible on where they are on the spectrum, and it's time to move on. I mean, I don't think the story is about Jimmy. I don't think it's about the rest of the kids and who they support. I think it should be more about what are the messages coming out of these presidential campaigns, and do Arizona support one or the other?
Well, and Gail, Vice President Harris has touted support from, you know, a certain number of staffers from McCain and former presidential candidate Mitt Romney and former President George W. Bush. Do you think that these endorsements, this crossover appeal, will that move the needle on some of those undecided, maybe independent voters that you were talking about earlier?
So I don't know if it's necessarily about changing minds so much as it is about capturing a moment that's already occurring, right? These people are symbols of for those voters who, you know, were those straight ticket Republican presidential voters for several cycles and who, since the Trump era, have drifted away from the party. And they were already doing that. And I think this just reinforces that that's the right choice, that it's a safe thing to do, that there are so many others like them. And there are so many others like them specifically here in Arizona. And I think that's why the McCain story picked up so much.
Interesting. All right. Let's talk about a couple of polls that came out this week. The first one dealing with some of the initiatives that'll be on the very long November ballot. Maricopa County this week confirming it's going to be two full pages long. So this found from found that the Secure the Border Act, that's Prop 314, has about 63% support. And we've talked on the show in the past about, you know, how the abortion access measure, supporters hope it'll be a driver for Democrats, whether or not the Border Act would be the same kind of thing for Republicans. Are you surprised, Gail, that a pretty good percentage of Arizonans say that they support this, at least right now?
I think everyone acknowledges that there's a humanitarian crisis at the border, and it's not something that shocks people or that I'm shocked to see that people want to see action on. I think this is one of those issues where it's going to start strong, and you're going to see that support really drop once people get a peek at what a mess that language is, what we've heard from sheriffs and law enforcement about the impracticality of enforcing this, the cost to businesses, the separation of families that's going to occur under it. And I think that we're just starting from a strong baseline because people want action on immigration, and that's not shocking to me.
Well, Marcus, when you look at 63%, that's clearly not all Republicans. There's some independents and probably some Democrats in there as well saying, yeah, this seems like a good idea.
Yeah, I'll be surprised if it doesn't pass by more than 63%.
Hmm.
And I think that politicians on both sides of the aisle have consistently underestimated the frustration, not only in Arizona, but throughout the country, on the issue of illegal immigration. And to my point, I would argue that if you look at the Democratic platform that they just passed at the convention in Chicago, it is a drastically different platform that reflects Kyrsten Sinema's language, frankly, on illegal immigration, which is drastically different than the platform they adopted 4 years ago. So even the Democrat Party now understands that there is a major issue that they need to pay attention to and focus on. And this one's interesting because it also folds in, you know, a fentanyl penalty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I'm caught giving you fentanyl and you die, I go to prison.
And I know that was one of the stronger polling provisions within this poll. And I think that that really is something that, you know, is helping to carry those stronger numbers. And I think, you know, people want action, but they want a solution that's no longer just the tough on the border answer. They want holistic solutions where we have, you know, pathways for people to actually immigrate here legally and have a means of coming to America.
There was another, this poll also asked about a couple of other initiatives. I want to ask you about one of them, Prop 137, which will be the judicial retention measure. This one was not getting quite as much support. Marcus, you're smiling there. 31% of voters say that they don't think that Supreme Court justices and other judges who are up for retention should be, and think that, you know, if voters decide that a couple of justices shouldn't be retained this year, that they still should be.
Yeah, well, you just hit on a key component that I don't think has been explained very broadly, if you will. And I expect the opposition campaign to dive right in on this. But there is a retroactivity clause in here.
Mm-hmm.
And what that retroactivity clause means is that should you vote to kick out two Supreme Court justices, Justice King and Clint Bolick are on the ballot, should you choose to kick them off the ballot or kick them out of office, but you vote for this measure and it passes, that the retroactivity clause kicks in and they would, in fact, still stay on the bench. And I'm trying to explain this to voters so that they're a little less confused should this scenario pop out. But I think that the money for this one is certainly with the opposition campaign, and I expect them to spend a lot of money on it. I don't think there's a whole lot of money in favor of this.
Hmm.
And generally, voters do not like taking things away from them. So in this case, I'm taking away your ability to vote on those judges. And certainly we complain about it, having to go through that long ballot. But in general, voters would rather have the option than to have that option taken away from them.
Yeah. Gail, were you surprised that only about a little less than a third of voters said they like this?
No. Yeah. I think voters smell a power grab. They know one when they see one. And I think these, once again, are numbers that are going to get worse as people learn about this retroactivity provision. I know that there is a lot here that is deeply problematic. And I think people have a lot of frustration with our judges right now. And I think you're going to see that be shown at the ballot this November.
All right. That is Gael Esposito. I'm also joined by Marcus Dellartino. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Gael Esposito of Creosote Partners and Marcus Dellartino of First Strategic. Gael, let's start with another poll this week that looked into some of the county races here in Maricopa County and basically found that they're generally pretty close. The sheriff's race is tied 35%. The incumbent, Rachel Mitchell, leads in the Maricopa County attorney's race by 2 points. And the Democrat, Tim Stringham, is leading the Republican, Justin Heap, by 4 points in the recorder's race. All pretty close, and Democrats seeming like they're within striking distance, if not ahead.
Yeah, I think, once again, Maricopa County is becoming a blue county. And so I am not very surprised to see these county level races be this close or to see Democrats leading, especially as our county Republican Party has gotten more extreme. You know, I talked about Turning Point earlier. You know, they control so much of these operations. And, you know, Justin Heap is a perfect example of that, an extreme conspiracy theorist who is, you know, targeting our elections once again. And people are extremely tired of that. And I think even with Rachel Mitchell, who, you know, has her own problems with the right of her party, you know, there's been a lot of problems with that office. And I think, you know, even their handling of the quote unquote Gilbert Goons case is something where people, when they hear about that office, it's rarely a good thing. And I think that's going to be trouble for her.
So, Marcus, of those races, Rachel Mitchell is the only one who's an incumbent. I mean, you can kind of, here's my expert political analysis, ready? That when you don't have an incumbent, like sometimes it can kind of be up for grabs, especially in some of these lower profile races. But people know who Rachel Mitchell is. She's a known entity. She's been in office for a little while.
Yeah. And I, you know, nobody will be shocked that I have a slight, I don't always agree with Gail. so I have a slight disagreement on Rachel's record. And I think she's been a fantastic county attorney, to be honest with you. And some of the things that she's blamed for, frankly, aren't under her jurisdiction at all. And I find it laughable that some people hold her accountable, which she shouldn't be for those actions. But anyway, moving on. You know, she is well known. This kind of reminds me of last cycle. There's a decent amount of undecided still out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it shows it's close. But at the end of the day, she closed pretty hard and won that office over handily. I think the bigger surprise is sort of in the recorder race and the sheriff's race. And I'm only saying it's more of a surprise because I don't really think any of those candidates have been well defined yet. I mean, there really hasn't been a campaign out actively talking about the Democrat or the Republican in those races. And I find it strange that prior to Labor Day, you know, the regular Joe voter that isn't us that lives this every day was like, I'm going to go do some research on these recorder candidates. So I think there's a lot to shake out, particularly in those races as we get closer to Election Day.
Is there enough oxygen, though, for county races when you have a presidential race, a U.S. Senate race, some very high profile initiatives on the ballot?
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly going to get ballot fatigue this year. There's no doubt about that. My contention has always been if the Harris campaign had a boatload of money and they wanted to help out their down ticket folks, that we might see a scenario where the Democratic Party really throws down a substantial amount of money in some of these county races. And I use the Democratic Party word loosely. It's probably be a independent expenditure committee, you know, maybe funded by labor unions or whoever, but sort of the left side may participate more heavily than they have in the past.
Gail, do you see a challenge for any of these county sort of down ballot candidates, as Marcus said, trying to define themselves, trying to talk about who they are, what they believe in, maybe who their opponent is with everything else going on out there?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is going to be a crowded race and, you know, these crowded ballot and these races are going to be very tight. I think we are going to see unprecedented investment in the state of Arizona. But I do also want to push back in that I think there is an awareness of county level candidates in a way that is also unprecedented because these offices have been at the center of so much media attention, both locally and in the recorder's office case nationally. People are aware of what that office does and what it means to their vote. And so I'm not surprised to see that folks are have a baseline of awareness there and that Tim Stringham is ahead.
Marcus, we've been talking about the long ballot. One person we don't know if they will be on that ballot is a gentleman named Michael Way, who's running for a House seat. You like that segue there?
That was a great segue.
Thank
you.
Was awesome.
I was thinking about that for a little while. he's running for a House, a Southeast Valley, Queen Creek area, a House seat. And he's being challenged based on residency under the with the fact that he has voted in North Carolina for the last couple cycles and seemingly doesn't meet the residency requirements to run for office here.
Yeah, it's a strange case because we've waited till after the primary election to have this mess on our plate. And what's probably most interesting to outsiders is that the people who are challenging this in court are Republicans, not the Democrats. And so I think Republicans are looking at this as a we better clean up our mess quickly before the Democrats are able to seize on this and pick up a seat there, I think is the thought pattern. But it is increasingly becoming concerning as election day and well, ballots get mailed out here relatively soon.
Yeah.
And I think they're starting to see we're feeling a little panic going on out there.
Well, so Gael, if Michael Wei is not on the ballot, in theory, there's a chance that a very conservative district could send a Democrat to the state house, which could, in theory, flip the balance of power in the House.
Absolutely, yeah. And his name's those ballots are printed. His name's going to be on that ballot, and it's just going to be a matter now of whether those votes are actually counted or whether there is only one Republican that is eligible for two House seats, and the single Democratic candidate there gets the other one. And I think I would enjoy nothing more than fake elector Jay Kaufman's district sending a Democrat there to represent them at the legislature as well. So I think let the Republicans fight, and hopefully Democrats get a victory out of that.
Gael's popping popcorn. You had a kind of a pained look on your face.
Well, I'd only caution people because I've heard this before. Like this, somehow this seat is the balance of power in the House of Representatives, and it's not. That is a long, long way to go for Democrats to take control of the state House of Representatives. And so this is, does it pinch the Republicans' margins? Absolutely. But I don't think it'll make a difference on who's in the majority.
I mean, and we should point out that courts have taken kind of a, I don't know what the right adjective is, but they've not ruled against candidates very often in residency cases. I wonder, though, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I don't think either of you are lawyers either. This seems to be maybe different in the sense that, like, this isn't sort of within a district. You know, do they live in a district or they live, you know, a few blocks over? This is somebody who voted in another state.
Yeah, and I think that that's the biggest piece here because I think you're right. Residency cases normally I shrug off as well. It's, do they actually rent here or do they not? You know, Wendy Rogers is a good example of that. But yeah, voting in another state is probably the clearest evidence that you do not live here and you lived there. And so I think that is going to be a really hard hurdle for them to overcome. But I agree with Marcus. This isn't going to be the thing that determines control of the House, but it may give Democrats a nice little buffer when they do win.
What do you think? I mean, is this a different kind of case in your mind?
Yeah. The whole out-of-state component, I think, makes it sort of a little bit of a night and day comparison. You know, people forget. I mean, Congressman Bob Stump from 100 years ago, you know, didn't live in his district initially.
West Valley Congressman.
Not to be confused with Bob Stump, the CorpCom guy, who was much younger.
And didn't have a district because he was a statewide officer.
Correct. So, you know, we've had a lot of examples of candidates not living in their specific districts. But we have not had a case where the candidate was living in North Carolina or Michigan or Ohio and being a candidate first. So it's going to be a tough hurdle.
So what's your gut feeling? How do you see this case resolving itself?
I have no earthly clue how this is going to go, but I would be surprised. I would be surprised if the judge did not rule that he did not have residency.
Gael, what do you think?
Yeah, I have no idea either, but you're right. I'm popping popcorn, and I'm enjoying this low stakes win for me, possibly.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Gael Esposito, Marcus Dell'Ortino, thanks you both for coming in. Really appreciate the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, yeah.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how jazz improvisation can be like having a really good conversation. But first, tomorrow evening, a new Miss Navajo Nation will be crowned in Window Rock, Arizona, the 72nd Miss Navajo Nation, to be exact. And this isn't your average beauty pageant. You won't see any parading in swimsuits and high heels or pageant gowns. Instead, the six contestants have spent this week butchering a sheep and demonstrating their fluency in the Diné language and culture. Amy N. Reeves-Begay is the current Miss Navajo Nation. The 25-year-old ASU master's student won the sterling silver and turquoise crown at last year's competition. Some of her highlights from her year-long reign, going to the Olympics in Paris this summer, tops the list, as well as several trips to Washington, D.C. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it all, her own time as Miss Navajo Nation, the unusual pageant that got her there, and what it'll feel like to crown a new Miss Navajo tomorrow.
You know, I'm just an ordinary girl coming from Kayenta, Arizona, and never did I ever think I would end up in these places or have gotten the chance to meet really important people and for them to be able to listen to what I was advocating for and for them to take the time. So I think that was the highlight of my year.
Yeah, amazing. So tell us a little bit about this pageant. Like, the history of the pageant goes back to the 1950s, right? But it's not like an ordinary beauty pageant in any way. Like, there are no swimsuits, no ball gowns here. You're doing very different things to compete for this title, right?
Yes. So actually, this will be our 72nd annual Miss Navajo Nation pageant. We are very, very different from a regular beauty pageant. And I think what makes our pageant really special is that for the Miss Navajo Nation pageant, our girls go through a week-long pageant. And so during that time, they get judged on, actually, on Monday, they will be beginning the butchering competition.
Right.
And so
that's not a normal pageant competition activity, right?
Yeah. And so that's what makes it really different is we have our girls butcher. I can't remember what year the butchering competition was implemented. And so from that point on, the Miss Navajo Nation contestants have butchered a sheep.
Wow.
And you're probably wondering, why do they have to butcher a sheep? It's really out of the ordinary. That's why. I was one of the girls that always thought, you know, why do I have to butcher a sheep? It's so hard. But honestly, though, when I went through the process of learning, I really understood why the butchering was implemented into the pageant. So sheep is actually one of our main sources of food. Mm-hmm. And so for myself growing up, I always saw my grandma and my aunts and my mom butcher. And I was always afraid and I never knew the purpose behind it. And when I did, for me to be able to carry on that tradition that was passed down from, you know, from my grandma to my mom to me, but of course to my great grandparents and so forth. Mm-hmm. And to really understand that back then, you know, this was our way of life, was butchering to provide food for our homes, and that this was a basic necessity that, you know, our people thought that our young girls should be aware of. Mm-hmm. It's a long process. In the afternoon, though, we will be having our traditional foods contest. We pretty much use the meat or the intestines. They will be making multiple other traditional cuisines. And they will only have about 2 hours to complete that. They will be having to cook on an open fire. Mm-hmm. And so during that time, they won't be able to use lighter fluid or anything like that.
Wow. So some different activities there. You talked a little bit about what it felt like to have the crown. What did it feel like to win the crown last year when, like, you spent all this time preparing and deciding to do this and then you won? Like, what did that moment feel like?
So if you look back at the pictures when I was crowned, I honestly couldn't believe that I had won, because that throughout my years of doing pageants, I never really won. And so I always took first runner up. And honestly, when I came into this competition, I thought, yeah, I'm probably just going to win a couple of categories and I will be content with that.
Yeah.
Because I know that this pageant is very prestigious. So when they had called my name, I was standing there thinking, okay, what did I just get myself into? just because all these years, I never really experienced, you know, winning in general. And so when the tables had turned, I thought, okay, this is it now. this is my moment and I'm going to take advantage of it. And so I didn't cry or anything. I was honestly just a deer in headlights thinking, where's my mom? I want to see my mom. And, you know, what is my mom and my dad going to say? And just all of those thoughts coming into my mind. And the moment when the crown was placed on my head, I honestly felt really different, knowing that my life had changed in that very moment.
So tell me, I have to ask you about the crown, because this thing is really huge and looks really heavy. It's made of sterling silver?
Yeah, so our crown was actually made by Matthew Charlie out of Vanderwagen, New Mexico. And this crown actually weighs 2.5 pounds of silver.
Wow, that's big.
You can imagine how heavy it gets after about an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you're outside in the heat, it tends to heat up just a little bit. So, but the story of the crown, it represents our women deities, Changing Woman, First Woman, White Shell Woman, and Spider Woman. So in the crown, that's why you can kind of see the mother of pearl at the top. You can see the spider webs on the side along with the turquoise. It represents your home, your safety net. I was always told to really watch what you say, especially around when you wear turquoise or just any stones in general, because from my home teaching from my grandma, it was that our turquoise, they hear and they feel everything that you feel and what you say. They listen. In a sense, they're alive. And so to be able to have that protection all around me, I'm really grateful for that. I'm going to miss my journey with our beautiful crown.
Yeah, that's a beautiful meaning behind it as well. Okay, so you will very soon be handing over the crown to the new Miss Navajo Nation. What advice do you give to these six young women who are competing this year?
Actually, I've really thought about what I wanted to say to them. And from the very moment they became contestants, I told them that this was going to be a journey, a lifetime journey. When you're Miss Navajo Nation, nobody tells you how to be Miss Navajo Nation. There's no rule book. There's no like etiquette book or anything like that. It's really based upon how you want to present yourself, and that each Miss Navajo Nation, we advocate for different things. And for myself, it was higher education, but also promoting the values of family teachings within the home. So I would just like to say to the next Miss Navajo Nation is to really show who you are, be passionate about what you talk about, because our people and our youth, they really look up to Miss Navajo Nation.
Yeah. So what's next for you? You're a master's student at ASU. I'm sure this isn't the end of your story either.
Yeah, it's not. So I will be going back to ASU. Well, I actually started my classes. I'm hoping to graduate in medical nutrition. That's what my concentration is in. And I have always wanted to work for my people, to serve for my people. With my medical nutrition background, I would like to become a registered dietitian and to really educate our people. And I would like to take my service to the other 500 tribes within the United States. Because there are times where I have traveled to very, very little reservations to where they barely have a clinic. And so that's where I see myself, is to serve other tribal communities as well.
All right. Yeah. Well, best of luck to you. That is Amy N. Reeves-Begay, Miss Navajo Nation. Amy, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us about all of this. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. I'm joined in studio now by the show's Sam Dingman. Hey there, Sam.
Good morning, Mark. To state the obvious, we basically make a living talking to people.
That's
right?
A pretty important part of the job, yeah.
Yeah, that and remembering to press record before the interview.
Yes, hopefully.
But I was wondering, when's the last time you thought about how you talk to people.
I would think it'd be pretty tough to think about how you talk to someone while you're actually trying to talk to them.
Exactly. And yet, I bet there's a lot of people who listen to you on the show every day and think, how does he do that? And that's certainly how I've always felt when I listen to jazz musicians improvise. Recently, I got the chance to ask one of my favorite jazz musicians how he does it. His name is Joshua Redman. He's a saxophonist who's been nominated for multiple Grammy Awards. And he and his band are coming to the Musical Instrument Museum next week. And what Joshua Redman told me is that he thinks about playing jazz just like you and I think about talking to people.
When we have conversations with people, they tend to have their own natural narrative arcs, right? There's a logic and there's a flow to them. But if it's a really good conversation, we're not thinking about, you know, the themes of the conversation and how we're like, you know, elaborating on them. We're not stepping outside of that. At least I don't think most people do when they speak with other people. You know, it's a natural process, like communicating with someone else, using the same language and telling your story and listening to their story. The more that musical improvisation feels like that, the more successful I think I'm going to be in having some sort of organic logic to my improvisation.
Sure. I love this idea of the solo is a conversation where the language is notes and the other participants in the conversation are the drummer and the piano player and the bassist and whoever else you're playing with. And speaking of ensembles and your work, I find that you do something that other saxophonists who I have been fans of over the years don't do as much, which is that you often have melodies that you're playing on the sax and you're harmonizing with the piano or the bass, or in the case of your most recent record, with the vocalist, Gabriel Cavassa. They feel like they're more than a rhythm section that's there to just kind of form a bed for your lead lines.
I don't know. You know, I feel like I'm a natural rhythm section player, but trapped in a soloist's body. <You know? laughs> I do have rhythm section envy in that sense. Like I want to just be in the thick and thin and the push and pull and the ebb and flow of it all. I love the groove, and not the groove isn't just a rhythmic thing. It's also a harmonic thing and the way, you know, the melodic implications. I mean, for me, I feel like I'm only as good a soloist as I am able to situate myself in the groove that everyone is creating.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I have to say, any other Joshua Redman fans that are listening to this as you're talking about groove are reminded of the fact that one of your first albums was called Freedom in the Groove.
I guess that's still like, you know, I made some bad albums, but I still like some of the titles of them.
This is fascinating to me. Are we breaking news here? Are you not as attached to that?
No. I have a hard time with much of the stuff I've done. I had like a 30-year rule, like maybe like 30 years after I've done an album, I can finally like come to terms with it. So like, you know, I feel like I finally came to terms with like my first three albums, but you know, Freedom in the Groove, we're coming up on, that's 2026. No, my main point was that like, I mean, you know, Freedom in the Groove is kind of a cheesy title, but it is kind of like what I was after then and what I'm after now, you know?
Totally.
And you know, another record I did, I think right before it, a live record called Spirit of the Moment, you know?
Yep.
Again, you know, kind of a basic title, but yeah, that's what I'm about, you know, still. That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and just to say, you know, for me as a young wannabe jazz player, one of the things that was really appealing to me about those early records, Freedom in the Groove in particular, was that there was so much groove on it. Thank you. at a time when I was still struggling to wrap my head around the utter freedom of jazz forms, having some tracks on those albums that did have a little bit more of a straight-ahead groove to them really helped me kind of get on board with the idea of what jazz could be.
For sure. I mean, a lot of the most profound statements in jazz are, you know, these colossal achievements of intellect. But I think that the level at which we experience them, where they truly have impact on us and are lasting, I think that cannot be explained by the intellectual rigor of the music alone.
It makes me think of your framing of a solo as a conversation. If you think about having a conversation with somebody, you're not just paying attention to the words you're saying back and forth to each other. You're also, if you're a good conversationalist, paying attention to the tone of the conversation, the kind of emotional energy that it has, the excitement or tentativeness with which subjects are being brought up. And so it's not just that you're spitting words back and forth at each other. There's an additional layer to it, and it's the combination of your ability to intellectually follow the conversational track and to pay attention to the emotional dynamic that makes it a good conversation.
Yeah, and I think that there are always, especially live, there are elements that everyone can relate to. Like, I think groove is something that, you know, like an infectious groove, like that it's mysterious, like when human beings like come together to lock up and connect rhythmically. That's something that most people can feel. Or maybe, like you said, like a tentativeness, like a delicacy or a kind of you know, tenderness. These are all gateway, gateway drugs, right?
You know, totally.
And then you know, you build a familiarity with it.
Yeah. So speaking of building familiarity, there's a question that I love to ask saxophone players in particular, and I'll put it to you, which is, I am a fellow saxophonist, albeit far less talented. But one of the things that I tell people about playing the saxophone is that it is an incredibly annoying instrument. What I have found annoying about it historically is that even if you get to a place where you have some solid technique, you know, you can finger all the notes, you can blow with a consistent tone, you know, you can play in tune, all those things. For some reason, for me, if you don't have the right cocktail of reed, the right mouthpiece, and just the physical horn itself, the way the keys fall under your fingers, if you don't have that mix right, it can feel almost foreign.
Yeah. I agree with that in the sense that I think ultimately what I'm striving for, and I think what a lot of us are striving for, is for the instrument to disappear, to feel a sense of, I mean, it's kind of like a platonic ideal that you're never going to achieve, but like this sense that the instrument ceases to become something separate from you. I think this is true with all music, but jazz in particular. There is this element of kind of like mystery that you always want to preserve. Like, there's an impermanence there. You know, it's built into the way we approach this music as improvisers, right? Like, like the song is what it is, and we have to honor that, but it's also going to be different every night, you know? And that's what's fun about it. It's always changing.
I mean, yeah, and to go back to this idea of a great conversation, what makes a conversation really great is that you can't have the same conversation twice.
Exactly.
Well, Joshua Redman will be at the Musical Instrument Museum on September 12th at 7:30 p.m. And thank you so much.
Likewise. This is, you know, I dread interviews, and I actually really enjoyed this one. You're
so awesome. Glad.
Thank you so much.
And on that jazzy note, that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. As a reminder, you can always follow the show on Instagram. All the cool kids are doing it. You can follow us there at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks again for listening. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.